We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the Papers podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. In this series, we speak to authors of papers published in one of ACAM's three journals. These are the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, commonly known as JCPP, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health, known as CAM, and JCPP Advances. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Manon Roll, postdoctoral research fellow at the Department of Psychiatry, University Medical Center Groningen, the Netherlands, and Dr. Charlotte Cecil, an associate professor within the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and the Department of Epidemiology at Erasmus Medical Center Rotterdam, the Netherlands. Manon and Charlotte are co-authors of the paper DNA Methylation at Birth and Lateral-Ventricular Volume in Childhood, a neuroimaging epigenetic study, recently published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. This paper will be the focus of today's podcast. If you're a fan of our Papers podcast series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Manon and Charlotte, welcome. Thank you for joining me. Can you each start with an introduction about who you are and what you do?
Yes, sure. Hi, Joe. Many thanks for having us. I'm Manon, a postdoc at University Medical Center Groningen in Netherlands. I currently focus on substance use disorders. By using genomic data of the parents and the offspring, I look at how substance use behaviors are passed from parents to their children. And I did my PhD in the child psychology and psychiatry, mainly on genes and the environment interplay on child neurobehavior development, together with Charlotte as my PhD supervisor.
Great, thank you. And Charlotte?
Yes, thank you very much, Joe, for having us here today. So my name is Charlotte Cecil. I'm an associate professor in biological psychopathology at the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam. And as Manon said, we're really interested in our group is to just better understand how children's genes and their environmental exposures beginning from pregnancy actually come together at a biological level to shape their development, mental health, and also the risk of developing psychiatric disorders later in life. And one of our core focuses, as you'll hear more about in this podcast, is epigenetics. And we look at this using sort of large-scale longitudinal data sets from the population.
Brilliant. Thank you both. So we're going to look at your paper today, published in the JCPP. But before we go into the detail, I want to get to grips with some of the concepts and terminology used in the paper. So this would be for listeners who may not have a background in genetics. Can you start with lateral ventricular volume enlargement? What is LVV enlargement and why is it of interest to you as researchers?
The lateral ventricles are the two largest hollow structures in the brain, located on the each side of your brain. And something is important to know is that the ventricles are the place to produce and circulate cerebrospinal fluid. This special fluid helps to keep the brain protected and healthy. For instance, it provides the fluid cushioning for the brain. So when you get a knock on the head, your brain doesn't hit the inside of the skull. And the reason why LVV is interesting for us is that we know for many neuropsychiatric disorders, the volume of the lateral ventricles is enlarged. That's a very strong finding, particularly in schizophrenia. Yet we still don't know much about what determines LVV size and whether we can identify some of the influence earlier in life before the onset of the neuropsychiatric disorders.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, that's really helpful. Sticking with the basics, your study refers to the epigenetic process of DNA methylation. Can you explain what this means in lay terms?
So epigenetics is quite a broad term. It's an umbrella term that literally means above the genome. So it's a layer of information that sits on top of your DNA. It's actually, you can think of it as a collection of different sort of chemical tags that regulate the expression of your genes without actually changing the DNA sequence itself. So you can think of the DNA sequence as something that's really stable and sort of provides instructions for everything that your body needs to develop and survive and function. And whereas this DNA sequence is very stable, the way that it's actually used by your body in different parts of your body, different cells, or at different times in your life, it's very dynamic. And that's thanks to epigenetic processes. So basically, they are a set of processes that enable us to use our genetic code more flexibly by regulating where in your body and when in time your genes are switched on or off. There's different types of epigenetic processes. And in this paper, we focused on one of these processes called DNA methylation. That's also because it's just the type of epigenetic process that at the moment is by far better understood and most researched. But it's important to know it's not the only one. Other processes exist and they're likely very important as well, but we just don't know so much about it. So briefly, DNA methylation, it involves these little chemical tags called methyl molecules that basically stick to the DNA. And depending on the location and the amount of these molecules sticking to the DNA, that regulates how accessible your DNA is and therefore how much it's read and how much the genes are activated. To conclude, why we are interested in it in this particular study is because there's more and more evidence suggesting that DNA methylation patterns are interesting because A, they're influenced by your genes, but they're also influenced by your environment. So environmental factors, again, beginning in early pregnancy can have an influence, can sort of get under your skin and change the way that these chemical tags are sticking and where they're sticking. And that could explain how your environment can influence your long-term development, really at the level of changing the way your genes are expressed. So that's really interesting to us. Secondly, it's very essential for healthy development and especially brain development. And finally, alterations in these DNA methylation patterns have been linked to poor mental and physical health outcomes, including schizophrenia. So to us, it's a really nice biological system if we're interested in better understanding how genes and environments come together to shape development and health.
That was excellent. That's really, really clear. Let's turn to the paper now. So this is DNA methylation at birth and lateral ventricular volume in childhood, a neuroimaging epigenetic study recently published in the JCPP. Can you give us an overview of the paper to set the scene? What did you look at and why?
Previous studies have shown associations between DNA methylation measured in blood and other brain structure in patients with schizophrenia. However, they are mainly cross-sectional. In other words, epigenetics and the brain structures measured only once at the same time point. And also most of them are used the clinical sample of adults. As such, that's very unclear what's the timing and the direction is of the DNA methylation brain psychiatric symptoms associations. Then the question came up is that changes in DNA methylation lead to changes in brain structure, increasing risk for schizophrenia, or is it that individual already diagnosed with the schizophrenia showed epigenetic and brain differences? For example, because of a medication use or other factors related to this condition. So I think it's really crucial to address this direction issue if we want to better understand the role of DNA methylation in psychiatric risk and inform the potential translational applications. So in this project, our goal was to use data from two prospective studies to figure out three questions. First, would DNA methylation early in life associated with developing brain, specifically LVV, in the general population before psychotic symptoms manifest? And if so, we're wondering, are the associations stable and dynamic over time, as the DNA methylation can be very dynamic? Then we're also wondering, can we trust other our results? Do these associations still exist in an independent sample?
Thank you. Can you tell us a little about the methodology used for this study?
In our main analysis, we used the data from over 800 children from Generation R study, which is an ongoing population-based study that has been following the lives of the children in Rotterdam from pregnancy to adolescence. And it's currently one of the largest epigenetic and neurodevelopmental cohorts in the world. I should mention here, it's quite rare to have this combination of epigenetics and brain imaging data. Before we turn to epigenetics, which was our main focus, we first wanted to ensure the relevance of the LVV as a risk marker of psychosis in line with the previous clinical studies. As such, we test whether LVV in childhood prospectively associate with psychotic-like experience in adolescence. Very important to emphasize here, because we are looking at the association in the general population during development, we study psychotic-like experience rather than clinically diagnostic psychotic symptoms. What we did is that we asked the adolescents to express, for example, whether other people have ever read your thoughts. And indeed, we found that association. Then our analysis proceeded in three steps. First, we performed an epigenome-wide association study, or EWAS for short, where we tried to test whether specific demethylation sites across the genome at birth associate with little LVV size during childhood. Second, we tested whether these epigenetic associations are stable or dynamic over time using repeated measures of demethylation across development. Again, I want to point out that such repeated epigenetic data during development is also very rare. Last, we put our findings to the test, sort of like a polygenic score from the field of the genetics, which represent a total genetic signal for a particular phenotype. Here in this case, we use our EWAS results to construct a polyepigenetic score of LVV that represent a neonatal epigenetic markers of later LVV. And then we test whether this score actually associates with LVV in a different longitudinal cohort, LSPAC in the UK. And the other points I really should mention here, although Generation R and the LSPAC are very similar cohorts, there are two key differences. LSPAC measured LVV in adulthood instead of the childhood, and the data was only available in males, not both sexes. As such, we cannot really call this replication per se, but a more test of how generalizable and reproducible findings are to a different cohort and age group.
Thank you. What key findings from the paper would you like to highlight?
From the EWAS using the demethylation at birth, we found that several epigenetic sites measured in cord blood at birth was prospectively associated with LVV at the age of 10 years. And interestingly, these sites map to genes previously implicated in brain development and also psychiatric disorders, including schizophrenia. And we also find indeed that epigenetic markers associated with LVV at birth still associated with LVV when demethylation measured later in life support a degree of the stability. Last, when we build a polyepigenetic score of LVV at birth in LSPAC based on our discovery analysis in Generation R, we found that this epigenetic score indeed significantly predict LVV in young adulthood in an independent sample of older males. That's the evidence of reproducibility. That was fantastic to see.
What is the advantage of capturing DNA methylation at different life stages, and how will this approach further knowledge in this field?
So as I mentioned earlier, epigenetic processes such as DNA methylation are really important for allowing you to use your genetic information more flexibly across the life course. And that's just really important for healthy development and healthy aging. So these are really dynamic processes, and that's a strength, but it's also a challenge because it's still very expensive to measure epigenetic processes in large enough samples. So the vast majority of epigenetic studies in the world just measure it at one time point. So you're capturing a snapshot of something that's very complicated and very time-varying. A lot of studies of epigenetics and schizophrenia, for example, have been based on postmortem samples. It's one time point and it's postmortem. And while this can be particularly relevant mechanistically, because you are looking at epigenetic patterns in the brain instead of, as we do in living individuals, in the blood. So it's more relevant maybe mechanistically, but at the same time, you're really looking at this endpoint. So you cannot look at developmental processes in vivo, which is going to be much more relevant, especially for clinical uses. And then even in living individuals, a lot of studies, as Manan mentioned before, really look at, say, the brain or psychotic or other psychiatric symptoms and epigenetics at the same time point. And then it's really difficult to establish the direction of these associations. So where Generation R and actually also Altsbach are very unique, I think, in the world, is that there are some of these few longitudinal studies with repeated measures of epigenetics starting from birth. So before any onset, behavioral manifestations or psychiatric symptoms actually start to develop. And because there are repeated time points, you can ask specific questions that you can't otherwise. For example, are your epigenetic patterns more sensitive to certain environmental insults at specific time points, maybe earlier in life, but not so much later in life? Or also, are epigenetic patterns at certain points in development more predictive of risk or future outcomes? And that's exactly what we've seen. So in another related project, but what we're starting to see more and more is that especially for certain neurodevelopmental conditions, epigenetic patterns at birth seem to be quite informative about your risk of developing neurodevelopmental conditions later on. And this signal can actually disappear over time. So there's something about birth, maybe because it's a closer proxy to fetal environmental factors or fetal biology that we know is very important for neurodevelopmental conditions. And actually, schizophrenia is more and more recognized as a neurodevelopmental condition. And maybe it's also more reflective of genetic influences. And as time goes by, maybe there's a lot of other things that are happening that wash out this early signal. What I mean? So having epigenetics at repeated time points can give you that insight about when in time you should be measuring these patterns and what's the relevant maybe for research and clinical evidence.
It's really fascinating. And what are the implications of your findings for researchers?
For researchers, I think there are two things to mention. One is we really need to understand better demethylation brain behavior associations and do more research from a developmental perspective. And that's crucial when we want to dig more about the role of the demethylation and brain in the onset and the persistence of the psychiatric symptoms. I think our study provides an example of how can work with multiple time-varying types of data on epigenetics, brain, and behavior to map these developmental links. And another thing I want to see is about the effort to improve the reproducibility. Although these differences between the two cohorts, as I said before, I feel confident that we really do our best, at least, to build this international collaboration and to test if the results still hold across time, across different cohorts and populations, across different measures of psychotic-like experience.
What about clinicians? How might your findings be translated into practice for clinicians? So might your findings pave the way for more targeted treatments or ways to mitigate risk for schizophrenia or for a different approach to diagnosis?
I think although I believe this is a really promising first step, our findings are still a bit too preliminary to be actually concretely translated into clinical recommendations. But I do believe that already what they can help us achieve is a better understanding of the underlying biology and developmental pathways that might underlie risk for developing psychotic-like experiences and psychotic symptoms. But I think what the ambition, where this really paves the way to, is trying to identify better ways of detecting risk early on before the development of symptoms. Because if we can detect things early on, we can put in place potential strategies to mitigate the risk and try to shift the risk trajectory and potential impairment that might result. I do think, however, what we do see from our results is that even though we identify associations, they make a lot of sense biologically, we're able to build the score and it's reproducible and that's fantastic, it's still explaining very little variance in our ultimate phenotype. I do not think that epigenetics will be the one answer. I think what is more likely is that epigenetics could be a very useful addition to a clinical toolkit or multimodal sort of algorithm or a set of biomarkers that might include genetics, epigenetics, other clinical information to help us really increase that predictive power. But one thing I want to say is that even if we're able to achieve that, so imagine that at birth, there is a way to meaningfully add some information about someone's later risk. One thing is to establish whether this is useful. Another thing is ethics. Like, this opens a lot of ethical potential considerations because we're not talking about a diagnostic tool at birth. We're talking about potentially a risk prediction, a way to increase your ability to predict risk. But like any type of risk prediction tool, it comes with potential error. It could be that biological risk never materializes into an actual impairment. What would that mean in terms of actionability? If you had a positive screen at birth, what could we do that really would help to shift that risk? And is that acceptable to stakeholders, to families, to individuals who experience these conditions, to clinicians, to public health? These are all kind of things that further down the line, as we're more confident in the ability to have useful tools, the next question is, should we apply them and how should we apply them?
Is there anything else in the paper that you would like to highlight?
One thing which I personally find interesting is that we found that associations between demethylation at birth and LVV are stronger in males. The polyepigenetic score worked even better if it's calibrated specifically for males. I mean, when only use the discovery findings from males, not the sex combined. Actually, this not only suggests potential sex differences in the association between demethylation and LVV, but it also shows that aligning discovery and the replication data as much as possible can lead to better precision and improve the predictive performance. I think it's in future study, it would be interesting to follow up to see why that differences do exist.
Well, let's talk about future studies. Are you planning any follow-up research, or is there anything else in the pipeline for either of you that you would like to share with us?
Yes, I think this was one of our first sort of dipping our toes in the water in the sense of how can we actually integrate and examine, as Manan said, what are essentially very complicated, high-dimensional, time-varying data types in multiple data sets. And so that was a bit of the beginning, I think, of a longer journey. I believe that in the field of psychiatric epigenetics, we've all been very interested in relating epigenetics directly to mental health outcomes, but we still know so little about how epigenetics relate to the brain itself in vivo. And that's why it's so important, I think, to try to do these neuroimaging epigenetic efforts. But the reality is, as Manan mentioned, that very few studies in the world actually have that combination of data of having epigenetics and brain across development, ideally at repeated time points, but that's what we need. So in that line, what we've done recently is to actually we established a new consortium, a new international consortium called MIND, which stands for Methylation Imaging Neurodevelopment. And we're actually bringing together ideally all pediatric cohorts that have neuroimaging and epigenetic data at different time points so that we can consolidate these international efforts, increase our statistical power to detect essentially what are small effects, and really map out in the first 20 years of life how your epigenetics and your brain and behavior relate to one another. So that's our big ambition going forward.
Finally, Charlotte and Manan, what is your take-home message for our listeners?
The study identifies for the first time demethylation markers at birth associated with LVV early in life, which can shed light on biology underlying this important brain feature. And also the polyepigenetic score might be more stable and reproducible than the single epigenetic sites.
Charlotte, do you have a...
Yes, perhaps just a more general comment, I suppose, that I hope what emerges from this podcast is just how epigenetic processes such as DNA methylation can be such an interesting biological system to to understand how our genes and our environments come together really at a biological level and how that can shape our development and later health. It also helps to explain potentially how environmental factors that occur very early in life can have such long-term effects, because it provides this sort of biological mechanism for embedding of experiences. And that's one thing that we didn't look at in this paper, is why do we find this signal at birth? And I think that will be another important for the next step, is like, what is this signal, epigenetic signal at birth, actually reflecting? Is it due to genetics? Is it due to potentially certain environmental insults in pregnancy or other factors that could help point to potentially modifiable factors that are involved in the etiology of schizophrenia risk that would also have important clinical implications?
Fantastic. Thank you both ever so much. For more details on Dr. Manon Rao and Dr. Charlotte Cecil, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoy the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.